Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Just a reminder to sign up for our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I've discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our sponsors and friends, Jana and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. I don't remember when I first learned that the Torah ends with the death of Moshe. I wish I did. It's such a haunting ending to the Torah that too often we take for granted because we have become so familiar with it. In Franz Kafka's diaries, his entry for October 19th, 1921, reflects on the ending of the Torah. This is what he writes. He has scented Canaan all his life. That he should see the land only before his death is unbelievable. This final prospect can only have the purpose of representing how incomplete a moment human life is. Incomplete because this sort of life could last forever, and yet the result would again be nothing but a moment. It is not because his life is too short that Moses does not reach Canaan, but because it was a human life. As I once wrote in an article entitled Unfinished Endings, there's a lot of wisdom within Kafka's reading. This is what I wrote in that article. In Kafka's reading, the Torah's ending reflects the larger reality of human life itself, which is nothing but a moment, an exercise in incompleteness. Our personal narratives don't fit neatly into a box. They don't have ribbons on top and rarely end with group hugs. Human life ends unrequited, ever yearning, ever hoping. As Aviva Gottlieb Zornberg writes, in her magisterial biography of Moses, veiled and unveiled, he remains lodged in the human imagination, where in his uncompleted humanity he comes to represent the yet unattained but unattainable messianic future. The uniqueness of the ending of the Torah is not just about how it ends, but how it was transmitted. Those final eight verses which tell of the death of Moshe are subject to a dispute in the Talmud. If you look on page 15 on Tezvav Amud Aleph 15a in Maseches Bava Basra, where the Gemara cites two opinions. One opinion says that the final eight verses were written by Yehoshua. The other opinion says that Moshe wrote them, but he wrote them with tears, bedema. Not only does the Torah end in such a sad way, there are actual Talmudic opinions that Moshe did not even write the final eight verses. How could it be that our teacher Moshe was not given the privilege, at the very least, of completing his own book? Whichever opinion is accepted, the final eight verses of the Torah are endowed with a special halachic status, as explored in detail by Rabbi Daniel Z. Feldman, my dear, dear friend, in his article, The Last Eight Psukim in the Torah. Of course, we link to it. As opposed to the normal conventions of Kriyas HaTorah, the public Torah reading, the Talmud says, Yachid Kore Osam, plainly meaning an individual can read them. In fact, the exact meaning of this halacha is a widespread dispute among the commentators, carefully discussed and presented by Rabbi Feldman. Still, we are left with a gnawing question why the Torah ends so unconventionally. Would it not have been a much greater honor for Moshe had he been able to finish the Torah without any halachic questions or special status hovering over the ending of the Torah? To understand this, let's explore some of the controversies that emerged in the wake of the passing of another great teacher, Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, or as he's known sometimes as the Rav, Joseph B. Soloveitchik, died on April 9th, 1993, which corresponds to Chol HaMoed Pesach, the 18th of Nisan, 5753, at the age of 90. Jamin Kaslow, who I believe is a lawyer now, partner law firm, was the one who reported on his funeral for Yeshiva University's newspaper, The Commentator. He wrote as follows: approximately 5,000 mourners filled the main sanctuary, the gymnasium, and the classrooms at the Maimonides School in Boston on Sunday, April 11th, in what officials said was the largest Orthodox Jewish funeral ever held in New England. For 2 hours, Tehillim were recited over loudspeakers at the school in memory of the Rav, Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik. The mourners then listened mentioned as the Rav's brother, YU Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik, Rav Aaron, eulogized the Rav. Rav Aaron called his brother the founder of the spiritual life of Jewish people. He had to penetrate information into students who were raised in an environment hostile to the Torah. The coffin was then carried down the street for a short distance as thousands followed. The Rav was buried in Bethel Cemetery in West Roxbury next to his wife Tanya, who died in 1967. Funeral organizers said that thousands more would have attended the funeral, but the last days of Pesach were beginning Sunday night, and many people from outside the Boston area were worried that they would not be able to return home in time. During his lifetime, Rabbi Soloveitchik was known, among many things, for his hespedim, meaning his eulogies. And after his passing, there was no shortage of students and family members who commemorated his life and legacy. Many of these tributes were later collected into the volume Memories of a Giant, edited by Michael Bierman. His passing was also noted in the New York Times with a long obituary by Ari Goldman. Reflecting on the passing of his grandfather, Rabbi Meir Tursky cautioned that Rabbi Soloveitchik should not be remembered in a small-minded way. In our attempt to understand, depict, and appreciate a few dimensions of the Rav's multidimensional greatness, Rav Tursky writes, we dare not lower the Rav Zatzal to our lowly spiritual station. Clearly remarking on some of the inelegant tributes that had already been made, Rav Tursky reminded that our personal insecurities or ideological inconsistencies must not distract us or cloud our vision of his multifaceted, harmonious genius and greatness. It is unclear who, if anyone, Rabbi Tursky was referring to, but for many of Rabbi Soloveitchik's students, there was one obituary that seemed to be speaking from a clouded vision. Just a few weeks after Rabbi Soloveitchik's passing, the May 1993 issue of the Jewish Observer, the monthly magazine of Agudas Yisroel, noted his passing with a description that many felt fell far too short of capturing Rabbi Soloveitchik's greatness. I'm not going to read the whole thing for you now, but of course I have it in the email. Under Rabbi Soloveitchik's name were the words Zichrono Levracha, may his memory be a blessing, rather than the more common rabbinic superlative, Yuzecher Tzadik Levracha, may the memory of the righteous be a blessing. Other subtle digs can be detected as well, including highlighting his admitted departure from the Torah world from which he came, as well as the cumbersome closing sentence. I personally hate the closing sentence. His passing leaves a vacuum in the specific role that he in effect created, a vacuum that cannot conceivably be filled by any other individual. Hardly the description of a true vacuum left after the passing of a rabbinic leader. In Zev Elif's article, The Jewish Observer, Champion of the Orthodox Rite, which discusses the legacy of the Jewish Observer, he notes how their obituary for Rabbi Soloveitchik was part of a larger effort to center Agudas Yisrael's ideology and marginalize those considered more modern Orthodox. Zev Elif writes, Rabbi Wolpin's editorials preached allegiance to Agudas' rabbinic establishment. Rabbi Nissen Wolpin was the editor of the Jewish Observer, often at the expense of the moderns, in quotes, and centrists, who sided with the Orthodox Union, Rabbinical Council of America, and Yeshiva University, and their champion, Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, whose obituary was rather muted and made mention of how the Rav was alone in the path he took. At the time, however, many senior students of Rabbi Soloveitchik were quite hurt by what they saw as an undignified obituary for a Torah giant. In the June 4th, 1993 edition of the Allgemeiner Journal, Rabbi Dr. Moshe Tendler, a student of Rav Soloveitchik and son-in-law of Rav Moshe Feinstein, published a full-page letter entitled An Open Letter to the Moetzes of Agudas Yisroel. His distaste for the Jewish Observer's decision to publish such an obituary is not subtle. He directly asked the Moetzes, the rabbinic body of Agudas Yisroel, why did you permit N. Wolpin, he doesn't call him rabbi, to soil the pages of your official publication, The Jewish Observer, in parentheses, May 1993, with a denigration of the greatest Rosh Yeshiva of our generation? He asks, referring to Rabbi Nissen Wolpin, longtime editor of the Jewish Observer. Rabbi Tendler then proceeds to list 8 offenses included within the obituary, which he deemed insulting, and urged for corrective action to be taken immediately. Given this context, a nearly Talmudic reading of an obituary measuring different slights in kavod, it is somewhat curious that Rabbi Tendler chose to use different superlatives in his letter for Rabbi Soloveitchik, to whom he appends the letters ZTL, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, and his father-in-law, which Rav Moshe Tendler writes after Rav Moshe Feinstein, ZTVKL, which stands for Zecher Tzadik tzaddik, the kadosh lebracha. May the memory of the holy righteous be remembered for a blessing. It's interesting he made that distinction while complaining about these kind of slights. Honorific slights aside, Rabbi Tendler concludes with an appeal, and I quote, for the sake of God's glory and his Torah, to immediately issue a rebuke to those responsible for the scurrilous article and an apology to the Rav Zatzal through his family and Talmidim. Rabbi Tendler was not alone in protesting the Jewish Observer's obituary for Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Menachem Ganak, also a student of Rabbi Soloveitchik, as well as the CEO of the Orthodox Union, published an article entitled Lo Chein Avdi Moshe, The Rare Quality of Hagon Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik Zatzal, in the Jewish press that also took issue with the Jewish Observer's obituary, which Rabbi Ganak called outrageously deficient. While Rabbi Ganak makes it clear that Rabbi Soloveitchik needs no defense, he ensures that the record is corrected for the standard of excellence that the Rav personified. Not everyone agreed with Rabbi Ganak's estimation of Rabbi Soloveitchik. One emerging Kollel student, let's pretend I don't know who it is, he actually made up with Rabbi Ganak. They're no longer, I think, I don't know if he apologized or whatever it is, they're not fighting anymore, but this emerging Kollel student, it's not me, I promise you that. One emerging Kollel student at the time, now he's a quite well-established Rav, wrote to Rabbi Ganak in the hopes of appealing to Rabbi Ganak's standing and understanding of the yeshiva world in order to explain why the yeshiva world at the time took such issue with Rabbi Soloveitchik. The 6-page letter to Rabbi Ganak lists grievances that the yeshiva world has with the legacy of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Apparently, the letter, while addressed personally to Rabbi Ganak, also made the rounds within the Jewish world. I'll read some of it. It says, Dear Rabbi Ganak Shlita, your article Lo Chein Avdi Moshe warrants a response. And of course, I have the article in the email as well. Your article Lo Chein Avdi Moshe, I'm not reading all 6 pages, obviously. Unlike the open letters of others, he's probably referring to Rabbi Tendler, whose disjointed ravings were dripping with hateful paranoia, your letter was clearly a sincere expression of pain and hurt. In the great Jewish tradition, you rose to defend the honor of Torah by expressing your outrage at the implicit defamation of your revered Rebbe Zatzal. I have also heard that you are a Talmud Chacham and a Ben Torah, one who cannot be lumped together with those windbag frumophobes who currently comprise most of the hierarchy of Yeshiva University. Yikes. These are all fighting words. Because you and your letter are unique, I want to answer you. Let me tell you why I find your well-intentioned words so grating. And then he continues to explain why the yeshiva world did not accept Rabbi Soloveitchik. And he has 6 pages of it. Rabbi Ganak responded to the concerns of the writer in the Friday, October 1, 1993 edition of the Jewish Press. After going through the writer's points one by one, Rabbi Ganak closes with a question, and of course, I quote, we all have an important role in the survival of Yahadus in America, and beyond our triumphalism and self-congratulatory delusions, we are sadly falling short of any reasonable goals. No one more than the Rav took joy in the full Batei Midrash of the yeshiva world, including Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. But where does this us-them mentality stop and Avas Yisroel begin? Battles over the legacy of Rabbi Soloveitchik would continue for years after his passing. As is often the case, individuals who identified too much to the right or too much to the left of Rabbi Soloveitchik struggle to appreciate the scope of his legacy and appropriately estimate the greatness of his character. In February of 1999, EIDA, a progressive modern Orthodox organization, held its first conference, Orthodoxy Encounters, A Changing World, at the Grand Hyatt Hotel in New York City. Although Rabbi Soloveitchik had passed several years prior, his legacy still loomed large at the conference. As the New York Times reported, when nearly 1,500, this is the New York Times, modern Orthodox Jews gathered several months ago for their inaugural conference, the figure who dominated the proceedings was nowhere to be found among the rosters of speakers or panelists or people there. Rabbi Joseph Dov Soloveitchik had died 6 years earlier and had ceased most public activity nearly a decade before that. Yet the convention of the group EIDA featured no less than 3 sessions devoted to the life and work of the Rav, the teacher, as Rabbi Soloveitchik was reverently known. 4 of his books were being sold. Even in a conclave thick with prominent rabbis and religious scholars, it was Rabbi Soloveitchik whom one saluted as the Gadol, or Great Rabbi. The conference, which discussed many emerging issues within the modern Orthodox community, such as women's prayer groups, was seen by many as a departure from the actual wishes of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Most notably, Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law, Rev Aaron Lichtenstein, publicly responded to the public use of Rabbi Soloveitchik's legacy to buttress the ideology of the two-year-old Eidah movement. In a March 1999 article published in the Forward entitled Take Rabbi Soloveitchik at Full Depth, Rev Lichtenstein implored his readers not to pigeonhole the Rav within the confines of a narrow camp. Rev Lichtenstein's words, which included a scouring critique of modern orthodoxy, are always worth revisiting. In fact, allow me to mention as an aside that my mother had this article, Take Rabbi Soloveitchik at Full Depth, from the Forward, hanging on the wall of her office for many years after it was published. I've read this more times than I can count. And this is, I think, the most powerful part of the article. Rev Aaron Lichtenstein writes, "Shallowness is, however, and I say this as a devoted friend rather than as an adversary, the Achilles heel of much of modern orthodoxy. As such, it elicited some of the Rav's sharpest critiques of religious modernism. Flaccid prayer, lukewarm commitment to learning, approximate observance, tepid experience, anything that reflected comfortable mediocrity in the quality of acculturated American Judaism, he deplored and sought to ennoble. This is not to suggest that he regarded the anti-modernists as his ideal. He had high standards of spirituality and few met them fully. But with respect to this particular failing, I believe it is fair to state that both intellectually and emotionally, he regarded it as afflicting the modern community more than others. His ideological commitment to the cardinal concerns of modern orthodoxy, an integrated view of life, the value of general culture, and the significance of the State of Israel, and his genuine pride in some of its accomplishments did not prevent him from demanding that it hold a mirror to its faith and probe for intensity and depth. Finally, Rev Lichtenstein concludes, the shallowest cut of all is the attempt to pigeonhole the Rav within the confines of a narrow camp. At the recent Eidah conference, a paper decrying right-wing revisionism concerning the Rav was widely circulated. Surely, however, left-wing revisionism in the form of convenient conjectural hypotheses regarding what would have been his opinion with respect to certain flashpoints is no less deplorable. Had the Rav been compelled to choose between what Ms. Kessler describes as the fervently Orthodox yeshiva world and its denigrators, there is not a shadow of a doubt as to what his decision would have been. The point is, however, that he did not want to make that choice, and he did not need to make it. He sought, as we should, the best of the Torah world and the best of modernity. For decades, sui generis, sage that he was, the Rav bestrode American Orthodoxy like a colossus, transcending many of its internal fissures. Let us not now inter him in a Procrustean sarcophagus, a sentence that Rev Aaron Lichtenstein is now famous for, because Lord knows most people are not familiar with what a Procrustean sarcophagus even is. But what a fabulous sentence. Let us not now inter him in a Procrustean sarcophagus. And that caution brings us back to our parsha and the death of Moshe. In the final retelling of Moshe's death, the authorship of the final eight verses are in dispute. Rabbi Soloveitchik explains this is why Moshe was crying. He wanted to be able to finish teaching the Jewish people Torah, and Moshe knew the transmission of his death would not have the same qualities of the rest of the Torah. So Moshe began to cry. All he wanted was to teach the Jewish people Torah. So what about the opinion that Yehoshua wrote the final eight verses? Why didn't Hashem, according to this opinion at least allow Moshe to write the final verses? The ultimate realization of Moshe's dream to teach the Jewish people Torah was accomplished by rendering Moshe himself unnecessary. Instead, his student wrote the final verses. A teacher is really only finished teaching when their very presence is no longer needed, when the presence of the teacher continues within the lives of the students. And this is the closing message of the entire Torah. Our teacher Moshe did not join us in the land of Israel, but his absence is the ultimate testament to his enduring presence. The Torah of Moshe continues to reside within each of us. And this explains the final words of the entire Torah, "Ulchal hayad hachazaka l'chal hamora hagadol asher asa Moshe le'enei kol Yisrael," and for all the great might and awesome power that Moshe displayed before all of Israel. What awesome powers of Moshe do these final words of the Torah refer to? Rashi explains, "Le'enei kol Yisrael," before the eyes of all of Israel, says Rashi, "Jeniso libo lishbor haluchos le'eneihem sheneemar va'ashabrem le'eneichem v'hiskima das hakadosh baruch hu ledaito sheneemar asher shibarta yasher kochacha sheshibarta." That the final words of the Torah are a reference to seemingly one of the darkest incidents in the entire Torah, when Moshe broke the first set of luchos in front of the eyes of the Jewish people. Why end on such a dark note? In fact, the Torah ends on this note as a positive reminder that Moshe's Torah now continues within each of us, the Jewish people. The shattering of the first set of luchos, the Beis Halevi explains in his 17th and 18th drashos, is what ensured that the transmission of the Torah in future generations would be from teacher to student rather than all written down in a book. The shattering of the first set of luchos is what made Moshe's role as teacher permanent for all generations. Yiddishkeit would not be able to be apprehended through a text. Instead, the Torah resides in the hearts and minds of the Jewish people within each generation. After the shattering of the first set of luchos, the Torah was no longer exclusively a text. We, the Jewish people, became the primary vehicle of Torah itself. Toras Moshe, the teaching and traditions of Moshe, continues through the generations from teacher to student. In Moshe's absence, we finally discover his enduring presence. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. This has been such an incredible journey. I am actually not quite sure what we are doing for next cycle, if I'm going to be doing this again. Please stay tuned. I'm working on developing all of these essays into a book as we speak. So please reach out, and anybody who has donated to this project since its inception, God willing, we will be mailing you a free book, and I'm so excited about that. And it is not too late to participate in that. To get the links to all of the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly Substack, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. And finally, thank you so much to my dearest friends and sponsors, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. I am so grateful to Janet, Lior, really to all of my friends who help us continue our work together. Thank you so, so much. This has been such an incredible journey. And thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.